Hello everyone, my name is Kim Westerman, Digital Marketing Manager at North Atlantic Books. I'd like to welcome you all to a webinar with Glenn Aparicio Perry, author of Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. Glenn Aparicio Perry is a writer, educator, international speaker, entrepreneur, and visionary, whose lifelong passion is to reform thinking and education into a coherent, cohesive whole. The founder and past president of the Seed Institute, Perry is currently the president of the think tank, The Circle for Original Thinking. He earned his BA in psychology from Allegheny College and then went on to earn both his MA in East-West psychology and his PhD in humanities with a concentration in transformative learning from the California Institute of Integral Studies. Perry organized and participated in the groundbreaking Language of Spirit conferences from 1999 to 2011 that brought together Native and Western scientists in dialogue, moderated by Leroy Littlebear. He is a member of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the Theosophical Society as part of a lifelong interest in bridging the arts and sciences. He lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you all very much for being here. Now I would like to welcome Glenn Aparicio Perry to our webinar. Thank you for being here, Glenn.
Thank you, Kim. It's a pleasure to be here. Welcome to everyone in attendance. Thank you. I'd like to begin with a prayer. The prayer is important. Beloved Creator, great mystery that underlies everything we see, touch, taste, hear, and smell on a beautiful afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share a message. Thank you for this day. Thank you for this beautiful day. Thank you for the spring, for the sap coming up. Thank you for the doves cooing today. Thank you for nature returning. Thank you for that, and thank you for the evergreen trees that stood guard over the cold winter. Thank you for that cold winter. Thank you for the snows that came up in the mountains. It was so beautiful and also healing for the land. Thank you for all the elements. Thank you for the light. Thank you for the air that we breathe. Thank you for the trees that give us the breath of life that we return to them in a sacred circle. Thank you for the water, because we're made of water. Thank you for the soil of Mother Earth. Thank you for these things. I'm so grateful for this day. Thank you for all the people that have contributed to make this day possible. Thank you for all the beautiful dialogues that were led by Leroy Littlebear for 13 years, from 1999 to 2011. Thank you for all the people that participated in the Seed Institute that helped to create those dialogues. Thank you for my editors, Joanne O'Brien Levin, Vesela Simic. Thank you for all the people that gave helpful, constructive feedback for creating the book. Thank you to my loving wife, Tomoko, who I could never have done anything without her. Thank you for the flower she just brought over here. It's very beautiful. Thank you for my amazing publicist, Jill Mangino, who even when she went through a major surgery, kept on working because she's superwoman. Thank you for Colby David, who helped me enormously with social media. Thank you for the members of the Circle for Original Thinking Steering Committee, Kennedy Braden. Thank you, Carol Hart. Thank you, Mark Burroughs. Thank you, Victoria Hansen. Thank you for all those people that have helped. And thank you particularly to the ancestors and for everything that has happened to bring us to this moment in time. Thank you, Grandfather Leon Secatero. Thank you, Grandfather Dan Moonhawk Alford. Thank you, Grandfather Tobasonic Canoe. Thank you, Grandmother Paula Gunn Allen. Thank you, Grandmother Patricia Clark Smith. Thank you to my own mother and father, Joan and Juan Caricio Perry. Thank you to Grandfather Bone, Grandfather Krishna Murdy, Grandmother Blavatsky. Thank you for all the ancestors of all the people that are on this webinar. Thank you for that, because we're standing on the backs of these ancestors. We couldn't be here without them. Thank you for that. Thank you for my four-legged ancestors, too, I just want to mention. Thank you for Adobe. Thank you for Satchmo. Thank you for Jingles. Thank you for Lobo. Thank you for... There's a lot more, so I'm going to say this stuff. Thank you for all those four-legged ancestors, because they give so much companionship and comfort and connect us to the animal world. That's wonderful. Thank you for coming for this webinar, and welcome. You know, I've said thank you probably 100 times here, but I want to start with one thing. The origin of thinking is actually thanking. So the title of the book is Original Thinking, but the origin of thinking is thanking. At least seven languages that I was able to investigate, so in English, French, German, Dutch, Frisian, there is a relationship between giving thanks or gratitude and thinking. In English, it came from the Proto-Germanic pancas, but that's too technical. But why is that? Why is there a relationship between thinking and thanking? It may have been because originally we felt blessed and loved by Mother Earth. We felt protected by her. And that may have been it. We had a more integral relationship with nature. But now things have changed a little bit. We're going to be talking about that today. We're going to be talking about time, progress, and what it means to be human. And we'll be just delving into a little bit, so we'll give everyone an opportunity to connect in and to contribute to the dialogue, to ask questions, if you will, or to comment from where you're coming from. That's very important. I wanted to begin, though, with a story, which I don't tell that much, but I did tell it in the book. And it's one of the reasons why I came to write the book, Original Thinking. One of my dearest ancestors, I mentioned it in my prayer, was Grandfather Leon Secretary. And Grandfather Leon, he was one of the sweetest souls. He had a soft, mellifluous voice. Oh, he was just a beautiful soul with the greatest of patience. Even his four children, who I'm blessed to know, said to me once that he never got angry at us. And that's pretty amazing. He was an amazing soul, and he was the head man and spiritual leader of the Canyoncito Band of Navajo, which is about 20 miles west of Albuquerque. And he invited me for several years, but I had thought, oh, I was too busy or too important or something, you know, to come, which was stupid. But then one year, things weren't going the way that I thought they would go, and we were doing a conference and hadn't registered, and I said, yes, I'm going to go. I'm going to do something different here. I'm going to go accept this invitation to go to the sacred grounds. And it's a long journey there, you know, and we go over hills, you know, dirt roads way back there. It's somewhere near Mount Taylor, but, you know, it's way back there. And it takes 3+ hours to get there, even more, because we're stopping to meet people along the way and stuff. When we get there, we enter the sacred hogan, which is not a building, but it's a ceremonial circle. And there we prepare for a ceremony. That evening, this is my first year there, of course, and that evening, for some reason, inexplicable reason, I was asked to tend the fire late in the evening. And so I did. And for the first time in my life, I learned about what tending a ceremonial fire really is. Feeding the fire, sacred sacraments, tobacco. You can even feed the fire food, coffee maybe if it's tired. But, you know, so you feed the fire, But then it came very late, you know, I mean, there's no clocks and watches up there, but, you know, it was probably about 11 o'clock, and we all went back to bed. So did I. But then, in the middle of the night, I heard the beautiful voice of Grandfather Leon Secatera whispering in my ear. And he just said, "Glenn, get up and tend the fire." But he wasn't there. It was just the voice in my ear. But, you know, it was a very cold night, and I had all my clothes on, so I just had to put on my shoes, and I could get up. So I got up, got out of the tent, and proceeded to fall over right away, because I was literally floored by the stars, which was this immense canopy. It really is the reason I moved to New Mexico. Because connecting with the stars at night is just an amazingly beautiful thing. We're the darkest state in the moon. So then I didn't turn on a flashlight, because I never do, but I could see the dim light of the fire off in the distance. I had ample light from the stars, so I walked to the fire. And indeed, when I got there, the fire was almost out. And I proceeded to replenish the fire, to build it back up to a big blaze. Then I went back to sleep. Turned out for a pretty short time, because we all get awakened, you know, almost 2 hours before sunrise. And I was misinformed. I was told by my dear friend, Christina Tona, that I would be awakening to these beautiful sounds of flute, Orlando Secatera, a great flute player. Instead, there's a guy who awakened us by Leland by saying, "Coffee! Coffee! You're burning daylight!" So that's how we awakened. But then that's spiritual in its own way. He's a leaf of coyote. And then we sang songs. The men, particularly the medicine men, sing songs around the fireplace. And those sacred songs awaken the sun. The camp is protected by warriors. They've been watching from a hillside over us all night long. After the sun rose, that is when Grandfather Leon Secatero came back to town. That's right. He wasn't there. Apparently, what happened is he got a message. Not a cell phone message or a text message, because those things don't work over there. But he got a message, psychic message, that somebody was lost. That's pretty remarkable. He got a psychic message that someone was lost, and then used a kind of remote viewing, if you want to use a modern term, to find out where they are and went to get them and to bring them to the camp. So he arrived after sunrise. And that means he wasn't there to whisper in my ear. So I was wondering, how did that happen? Did he bilocate his consciousness? He was able to observe the camp and see that the fire was dim and then whisper in my ear? That's kind of what I thought. But we went out for a walk that day. It's a sacred walk where we're giving blessings to certain sacred sites. And I thought I'd take the opportunity to ask Grandfather Leon about the evening. So I asked him, you know, "Why were you, I heard your voice in my ear at 3 a.m. How did you do that?" Well, as many of you know who work with elders, sometimes they don't answer you, because what you really need to do is not be thinking that way, particularly in a sacred place. It was important. He didn't answer me. He looked at the beautiful surroundings, and the message I got was, let go of rational mind. But much later, I found out that Orlando Secatera, his son, offered an alternative explanation. Orlando said that the fire was speaking to me directly, but the fire disguised its voice to be the voice of Grandfather Leon so that I would listen. And that's really profound to me, because then I realized that the origin of our thoughts, I'm not even sure I realized it right then, but But that is definitely the seed for the awareness that came later for me to write the book that traces the origin of our thoughts to be coming from nature, not from individual heads. You know, I've had many messages about this over time, and I think it's a very important message. Now, there were other reasons I wrote the book, because we have these beautiful dialogue circles, and in the very first one, Leroy Little Bear asked a question to the dialogue group. He asked, is it possible to come up with an original thought? And a very interesting thing happened when he asked that question, which is that all the Western people in the room, with the exception of one or two, tried to think of something brand new that had never been said before or done before. And all the indigenous people took the question in the room as an invitation to connect to origin as a place of ever-present regeneration, as a place also, it was said, of original instructions for how to live on the planet, which is that's something the grandfather Leon said. And that was very profound to me, too. It was only after this question was asked that I realized that that was the divide between indigenous and Western consciousness, that Western consciousness had actually shifted origin from a place to a beginning of time, whereas indigenous consciousness had maintained a relationship with their original, their origin, places of origin, and so that remains a place. And place is forever. My grandfather Leon would say to me, he doesn't think, he knows that the cosmos has always been here. But in Western worldview, our language, our syntax of our language, almost as Moonhoff used to teach us and as Carlos Castaneda wrote about, our syntax demands beginnings, beginning, middle, and an end. And so we think about when did the universe begin. And it doesn't matter whether it's 14 billion years ago or 6,000 years ago, if you're a fundamentalist Judeo-Christian, we in Western modern society tend to be addicted to the idea of beginnings, middles, and ends. That is the beginning of the illusion, because it's only an illusion, of time as a line. So, you know, in the book, I'm radically revising time, and this is a revision back to both what contemporary indigenous people think, but also what Western people believe for the longest of time. And one thing that people in the audience may not realize is that it's only really within the last 500 years that we started to embrace a completely different worldview, because something happened 500 years ago, almost exactly 500 years ago. We can pinpoint when, I'm going to show you in a second on a PowerPoint, we can pinpoint the beginning, the advent of linear perspective in art. Okay, so I'm going to go to PowerPoint now. By the way, that cover picture is taken by Michael Two Bears Andrews, and it's a good friend of mine, and it's a place that he took me to, which has become one of my favorite places in New Mexico, which is the confluence of the Red River and the Rio Grande. Oh, and we hiked down there. It's just beautiful. It's like an origin place in itself. Not very good with some technology. Okay, this is the book cover, if you haven't seen it already. Beautiful image from James Jarrab of Santa Fe. And it was his visionary art that was looking outside the Milky Way, looking in. But I wanted to bring us to linear perspective. Here's an example of linear perspective. This image is in the book as well. And you can see something that's happening here, which is that objects closer to the the central viewing place appear larger. Objects which are further away on the vanishing point line appear smaller. So what shifted in consciousness with the advent of linear perspective is that we now believe that the future is facing forward, and the future will happen the further it's away, that's the longer time it's going to happen. Things that are closer to us assume greater importance, and they're going to happen sooner. Our attention becomes focused on looking forward. And we say this very commonly in our current language, I'm looking forward to something. And that's always in the future. But, believe it or not, we didn't used to think like that. We used to think that the future was behind us and the past was in front of us. This is the way it was for the ancient Greeks. So for the ancient Greeks, and also you can read this in Carlos Castaneda's work about death is stalking you from behind. So what does this mean? Why does this matter? Well, once we shift our participation from being pulled with the rhythms of nature and coordinating with the rhythms of nature as they're naturally unfolding, to looking at the future ahead of us where we can see it, we begin to try to control that future. And that is the prelude for modern science, because science is about prediction and control. And you want to find verifiable data that you can reproduce. And there's a huge benefit to that. So never in my book am I saying that modern science is the bogeyman or modern science is bad. But there is a deep shadow side that has come about in modern science where we no longer realize that our worldview is not the only view that we could have. And what I'm seeking is to enlarge our worldview so that we can take the best of modern science, but we can also remember, recollect our other ways of thinking, which are also very beneficial. So here's an image I want to show you that does just that. Let's see. This is, and I could do this low tech too, because I have the book right here, but this is an image by Pablita Velarde, a wonderful painter who lived in Santa Clara Pueblo in New Mexico. It's called Old Grandfather Storyteller. And Old Grandfather Storyteller is in the center there, if you can see that center. I'm not sure if you can see me and the image at the same time, so I'm going to click myself off. Let's see. You should be able to see the grandfather storyteller in the center. That is not in perspective, obviously. The grandfather is enormous. He's pointing to the trail in the Milky Way that represents the ancestors. There's Spider Woman in the image. But then I want you to look at the buildings. The adobe buildings are in linear perspective. So here's the important message that we can take away from this. We can understand that we can use linear perspective or not. That we could choose to immerse ourselves in nature, or we could choose to have a distance from nature for some other purpose. Okay. So that's what I wanted to show you in PowerPoint, anyway, because it's hard sometimes to imagine that, but you guys probably would have been able to do it. But there are other ways of thinking about time. What Grandfather Tobosanica suggested is what kinds of things want to happen together, which is an amazing thing. And that really made me think, because later on when I went out in nature and sat for long periods of time, I began to realize that all things in nature are happening concurrently, that things don't happen one after the other. They do happen in a supportive way to each other. And that is a beautiful, beautiful thing to consider. So that is an important aspect of the book. Now, once as human beings we began to break away from the rhythms of nature, we also began to define ourselves as human beings in that way. That's why you can read many biologists saying that human beings don't need to procreate at certain times. And in fact, we do everything else in ways that flaunt common sense, like building buildings on the edge of cliffs or buildings right next to rivers that may overflow. There are many things that we do as human beings because we feel that we're in control. But I would say in the work of the Circle for Original Thinking is about remembering how to think as nature thinks, so that we can actually, it doesn't mean that we don't have free will, we do, but we now are aligning our free will to be with, concurrent with what wants to happen in nature, and that can be a very, very beautiful thing. There are other ways we define ourselves as being human having to be with language, where it may be really that what is language? Because it seems to me that all the other critters and the trees and the vegetables, you know, they all communicate too. We dismiss it in different ways. We say it's a chemical transmission. If you, you know, if you cut into one tree in a forest, all the other trees feel it right away. Why is that? Well, they're communicating somehow. We can dismiss it, but I don't think that's wise. It may be that our language comes from the land herself, which is what I say in the book. And there is a direct relationship between linguistic diversity and biodiversity that led me to believe that. Now, there's so many other things we could talk about, but I think at this time, it's best if we I'm going to shortly turn it back to Kim, and she can bring in some questions from people. But I will leave you with a few last thoughts. This stuff is important. If we as human beings think that our thoughts are separate from nature, that our thoughts are constructed in a neuronal way in our brain, that our consciousness is an epiphenomenon, and if that's too fancy a word, is something that came out of our physical structures, we're kidding ourselves. Our consciousness, our thoughts, come from relationship. They come from relationship with nature. They come from relationship with other human beings. The full continuum of thought must be reclaimed. Our gut instincts, our emotions, our heartfelt yearnings, our intuitions, they need to be part of thought again. That's a lot of what the book is about. Reclaiming the full continuum of thought. Seeing our thoughts as water. We're 70% water. Why shouldn't we think as water thinks? We do. We think in a circle. And that's okay. Don't ever let anybody say that thinking in a circle is not okay. All right, we'll stop there. For Kim, you want to jump in?
Hi, Glenn. Thank you so much. That was a lovely, lovely talk. I'd like to invite participants here today to type questions into the question window. You're muted, so you won't be able to use your headsets, but you can type your questions for Glenn into the chat window and I will retrieve them. A few people ask questions ahead of time and we can get started with those. Glenn, if I might though ask you, please turn off your PowerPoint and then your video screen will get bigger. If you're finished with the PowerPoint presentation, just shut that off and we'll be able to...
I think that's off now, but I will turn it off.
Okay.
I will turn off PowerPoint entirely.
Thank you.
Okay, how's that? Is that better?
Click on stop sharing your screen and we'll just have the webcam, I think.
Okay,
there you
sorry.
Go. Perfect, perfect.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, here's the first question. Can you explain how Native American versus Western interpretations of the word original differ, and what that reflects about each culture's respective consciousness?
I could. I already did. But I'll reiterate. Yes, there's a lot of definitions of what it means to be indigenous. There's the United Nations definition, which speaks to people who are dispossessed of their territory from a political aspect. But the definition of indigenous that resonates with me really comes to the root of the word. I love exploring words because that's how you understand the archaeology of the mind. To be indigenous, really, it's related, the word indigenous is related to a Greek endimna, which literally means the guts or entrails of the earth. So if you're indigenous, you are attached to the earth, attached to place in a profound way. It's almost as if you left that place or if you were forced off that place, which of course has happened many times, then there's a profound sense of loss. So for indigenous people, they're connected to origins of place. That place feeds them. There's no separation between history and geography for indigenous peoples because the history is held in the land. The vibrations are held in the land. So, you know, when you start like, right now vibrating a Tibetan singing bowl. Beautiful sound that will never disappear. All vibrations are permanent, as also the scientist Rupert Sheldrake understands, which is part of his theory about morphological fields. So vibrations are held in the memory of the land. Now, for Western peoples, we understood that very well for a very long time. And it used to be that our stories could not be told any other place but at that place, you know. And that's how some of the earliest Western stories came about, even, you know. And then when we began to believe in this idea of linear time, which really took off with the advent of linear perspective in art, then we began to move away from origin. So what we're doing is we're mistaking distance from origin and calling it progress. Now, it is a form of progress. It is a form of progress that I won't deny, but it also is distance from the origin. That's the direction that we're going, and there's a danger in that. Okay, I hope I did elaborate a lot more, so I'm glad that question was asked. Thank you, Kim. Go ahead.
Here's a question from a current participant. Can you speak more about languages emerging from specific locations on Earth and what happens to their languages when people migrate, whether forced to leave or when migrating on their own?
That's a great question. So I would refer the reader, not just to my book, or refer the questioner, I'm making it a reader, sorry. But also to an organization called Terra Lingua. You can look them up on the web. One beautiful organization that puts out a wonderful newsletter called Langscape. And that term was coined by, I'm blanking out on his name, but I'll come back to that. One of Dan Moonhawk Alford's earliest teacher, Sagesh Henderson. That's who coined the term landscape, which says it all, actually. So the Terra Lingua organization has done research to show that 10 of the 12 countries with the greatest biodiversity in the world also have the greatest linguistic diversity. So where you have rainforest and you have indigenous people living in rainforest, you have enormous birth of languages. Now, why would that be? I think it's because the languages emerge from the land herself. And that's what I experienced when I was in Costa Rica. I felt, you know, all the sounds, the emergent sounds, the monkeys, the birds, everything is, the rivers pulsing, everything is pulsing through you right there. So then the questioner asks what happens when the people travel to a different place. Well, I think if they're maintaining their beliefs, if they were forced out of their original place, they will very quickly form a relationship with their new place, and they will still be indigenous peoples. You know, for instance, it's hypothesized that the Navajo came up from way in Alaska or something and then came to the Southwest fairly recently. Whether or not that's true, because I don't necessarily believe all these things, but even if it is true, certainly the Navajo have a beautiful and profound relationship with their land here in the Southwest. So if they did move, they didn't move their ideas. They still connected with the land right away. I think what's happening in Western culture is that we are learning how to reconnect with the land. We are re-indigenizing ourselves to the land, and that's why we are refreshed, supported, and when we meet with indigenous peoples who are open to meeting with us. Thank you.
Here's a somewhat related question. Can time and space exist independent of place?
Oh, well, that question is in my book. And what I say is that it's the wrong question, at least for indigenous peoples, because of what Toba Sanikwe-Kanu talks about. He's more interested, and it seems more profound to me, to look at what kinds of things want to happen together. So long ago, also in Western culture, we merged time and space into place. Place was, of course, very important to us as well. And it needs to become again. Because you cannot do anything well without being fully aware of the place you're in. You can't plant well. If you know the place you're in, you know exactly when to plant, whether you're watching the stars and doing a kind of archaeoastronomy and planting together, or whatever it is that you are familiar with, that becomes your family. That's the origin of the word familiar, too. So when you're familiar with your place, you have relationships with the place. The place is your family, and that's for me is the goal.
Do you think that Westerners can really shift their perception of reality as objective and material to something else? And do you think that they really want to?
Oh, yes. Not only can we do it, we're already doing it. You know. So I mentioned 500 years ago the advent of linear perspective. But let's look at what's happened in the last 150 years or so. Things have started to shift. You had the French Impressionists who were painting, and they were, you know, the lilies were dancing, and all of a sudden the land was starting to come more alive. The Romanticists that write, Emerson and Thoreau, also in painting, you have Picasso, just throws up everything in the air, you know, and reconfigures the human being, forcing the person to create a whole out of the parts. And all of this is a reaction against overly rigid, linear thinking. And so it's already happening. It's already already underway. And the people who are on this call probably are part of that soul group. They're already open to the spirit that's moving through them. You know, I really do believe time is a circle. The ancient Vedic explanation of it is a beautiful one. I don't have a PowerPoint for that, but just picture the top of the arc, then pure spirit is descending into matter. and then it reemerges in the inverse order in which it originally enfolded. And out of that, that it feels like a journey home. That's what we're experiencing. We're experiencing that pull to come home. And so it's been a little bit of a side journey with the development of linear rational thought, but we need to recover the roots of rational thought, which we are in the word ratio, which means a relationship between things. So for the ancient Greeks, and I talk about the ancient Greeks a lot in the book because I think we have a lot to learn from them, for the ancient Greeks, rational thinking was the most developed form of thought, but it was the pinnacle of thought, they believe, but it was also the most beautiful form of thought because rationality comes through relationship. So for the Greeks, what was important was divine proportion, the sacred ratio, the golden mean. And I think that's what needs to be important. It doesn't mean we can't use rational thinking, but we need to first connect with the deeper wisdom, and then we use rational thinking in service of the deeper wisdom, in service for what wants to happen in nature. We make a choice to coordinate with what wants to happen in nature, and we don't just think of ourselves. That way, we will serve all our relations, which is really what every prayer is about. In indigenous culture, but not every prayer, I would say too. Thank you.
Have you ever heard of someone having a dream, waking up from that dream and being in a kind of shock because the dream was more real than the person's present, quote, reality?
Well, not only have I ever heard of it, I experience it all the time myself. So I don't have to go for other examples. I do speak about dreaming in the book. My personal belief about dreams is that it's a consciousness that's pre-perspective. So remember we talked about perspective, which creates a distance between the I and the world. And also, you know, this is very important. My perception of what happens when I'm dreaming is that there is no I. That consciousness is infused throughout all the aspects of the dream, which I think is why a particular form of therapy called Gestalt therapy works so well with dreams, though, you know, the Gestaltist takes every aspect of things in the dream and dialogues with it as if that was part of the person, the dreamer. And it really works. So, yes, the dreaming consciousness is very immediate. It doesn't have any of the distractions that we have when we're waking at all. So that consciousness is very important to learn from. And it balances our waking consciousness. But it doesn't just balance our waking consciousness. So when we awaken from dreams, I always encourage people to keep dream logs. I used to lead dream groups, and I'll do that as part of workshops. But when you watch your dreams over a period of time, what you will observe is that they tell a story. And you may be able to become aware of that dreaming consciousness, that thread of soul is continuing even while you're awake, kind of more in the background. But if you can tune into that, you will live a more harmonious and beautiful life. So it could be very useful. Thank you. Great question. Oh, by the way, in the background behind me is a painting by Howard McConaughey, dear friend, who's 95 years old. It's a Cubist-inspired painting. So he studied with Braque in France, if anybody knows Braque. So it's pretty cool. I happen to love the painting. So it happens to be behind where I sit and write. If I turned around the webcam, you could see the Sandia Mountains. Should I do that? No. All right, go ahead, Kim. Sorry.
If all is vibration, does thinking exist within the cosmos, and is it available for access?
if all is vibration, does thinking exist in the cosmos, and is it available for access? Definitely yes. There are terms for this. The Vedic texts speak about it as the Akashic records. I just think about it a little bit more simply, that it's very important to maintain a relationship with your ancestors. So I've been blessed to know some amazing people who now are in the spirit world, and I feel their vibration continuing. So I develop a relationship with them, and I think many in your audience will feel this too. When you lose a loved one, you may be able to almost, one of the things that may be the most healing thing is to be able to feel their energy come into your solar plexus and reside there. And then that person becomes almost a part of you. So whatever has been thought or said or done is still here. Because, think about this very simply. I mean, quantum physics understands this is, but just very simple terms, if you skip a stone on the water, the vibrations or the ripples get larger and larger and larger and then fainter and fainter and fainter. But of course, they're still there. And so, yes, we could tune into it. And if, some people are obviously better able to tune into it than others. And when they are able to tune into it, they kind of break through what you might call past, present, and future. And they begin to see across those seeming divides. Because those divides are fake. So in ancient times, even in the West, we spoke about the past and future calling to each other, deep calling to deep. Oh, I love that. Because that's what we can do. The past and future have a relationship. So it's all here. Go on, next question. I don't know how much more time we have.
Well, here's actually another question that's related to something you just brought up, quantum physics. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between native conceptions of consciousness and quantum physics?
Yes. I mean, I can talk about it a little bit, but I'm neither native or a quantum physicist, but I was blessed to organize dialogues between Western scientists, and a lot of them were quantum physicists, from Brian Josephson, Nobel laureate, Fred Allen Wolf, Stephen Gamboa Eastman, John Erskine. There were a lot of Amit Goswami. There were a lot of quantum physicists in our circle. And then Native American elders. There is one Native American quantum physicist in New Mexico. I think he's still alive. I mean, Fred Begay, who used to work up in Los Alamos. Fred observed early on that the quantum world was something that seemed familiar to him, somehow comfortable. Why is that? But inside the quantum world, what happens is more about process and relationship. It's about radical process and relationship. As my friend Moonhawk used to say, there are no longer any things in the quantum realm. And that's pretty mind-blowing. No longer any things in the quantum realm. When he said that on a Native American call-in show with Harlan McCosico, Harlan answered, that's deep. It is deep. Because our Western language is really related to linear perspective, like you were talking about. I make these connections in the book. So we have a language which is a subject-object separative language. There's a division between our subject and object, just like there's a division between our I and the world. But Native American languages do not have that, typically. So they are filled with verbs. But actually, that's one way of looking at it, and it's certainly the way David Bohm looked at it, and that's why David Bohm tried to create a language which he called the Rheo mode, R-H-E-O-M-O-D-E, Rheo from the Greek, meaning to flow. He tried to create a language all of verbs, basically by changing English into think to thinking, you could do it with names. Glenn, Glennie. Leroy Little Bear did that at one dialogue circle. He made everybody put ing at the end of their name. In English, we're top-heavy with nouns. So we usually see the world as stuck. But the quantum physicists got an insight into something else. And for some, that became the prelude of a spiritual breakthrough. Quantum physics doesn't in itself have a lot of spiritual principles necessarily inherent in them, but I would include David Bohm's idea of the implicate order as a very spiritual principle, because it's an idea that there's an implicate order that then expresses itself into an explicate order, that the implicate is the unseen world and the explicate is the seen world. So that's the best answer I can give for that. Let me stop there and maybe other questions.
Here's one on a slightly different topic, but back on the subject of time. Can you explain Little Bear's comment that I equals time?
Well, that's somebody that's read the book or has been at the dialogue circle. That's it. That's in the book. It was in the dialogue circle. Leroy is a master of dialogue, and he began a dialogue circle 1 year that was on time and origin, I believe. That was our theme, by saying that I equals time, but I want a divorce from time. And so when he asked that question, he was actually, by saying I equals time, he was encapsulating all of history in that little equation, which is pretty brilliant. Because long ago, I did equal time, but it was I was not an ego exactly, but time, the rhythms of nature were unfolding within you. We were just part of nature. We were part of the rhythms. We were in and of the earth. We weren't walking on the earth, if you understand the difference. That was a fascinating question because it presumes that we're connected with time, which is not the way people usually think of themselves. They usually rely on time by looking on their watch or some kind of other measure. And that can be very stressful. That can be very stressful. So that's a pretty complex question that was asked. I don't think I can answer it adequately in the few linear time units remaining. But I will say that it becomes a real blessing if we look at time in a different way. And I would suggest that something to the audience that Grandfather Leon said during the dialogue. He said, time is the fifth element. And I thought that was the most beautiful way of approaching this. I really thought about it for a long time because I wasn't sure what he meant. And I'm not even certain that my interpretation is correct and everyone else is perfectly, it's a good idea if everyone else can find their own interpretation. But for me, saying time is the fifth element meant to me that time was alive. Time was spirit. Time was the animating force that animated the cosmos. The ancients called it Fohad, according to Madame Blavatsky. I've never read it anywhere else except Madame Blavatsky. But Fohad, this animating force that brings things alive. So that makes sense to me. Because if time is the fifth element, then time becomes a part of us rather than something abstract. I have an objection to the idea of time as an abstraction. That was what came into being under Newton, and we began to measure time only in terms of intervals. But those things are illusory. Ultimately, you can't reduce time to intervals. We can use intervals for specific purposes, and we do that today. But I don't think it's a great way to go. I think it's better to allow ourselves to be in rhythm with what wants to unfold, and then we'll be at peace a lot more.
How do the Tibetans conceive of time and original thinking? You integrated this into your prayer, and I'm wondering if you have a perspective on Tibetans in particular.
I don't know. You know, I don't know the answer to that question. So I play with Tibetan singing bowls. I have never been a deep, deep student of a Tibetan monk, and I simply don't know.
Let's end with a question.
I could guess, but I prefer not to.
Okay.
Sorry.
Let's end with a question that really takes us back to the beginning, and I think it's a good place to end because most people here have yet to read the book. Is it possible to have an original thought?
Well, part one of the book does address that, and in the end of part one, I say something which I could say here. I don't like the dichotomy of yes or no, you know, is it possible to have an original thought? The question itself is a beautiful question because, as Krishnamurti said, the only questions worth asking are the ones impossible to answer. So it's really not possible to answer it exactly. You could think about it in terms of everything being original, everything coming from source, or you could think about it in terms of there's nothing new under the sun. So you can think about it in terms of place, that maybe everything is original because everything has an origin. There's so many ways to think about it. But one of the most useful for me was during one of the dialogue circles, Paula Gunn Allen, dear friend Paula Gunn Allen, a great sense of humor, and she spoke about Pueblo, the tradition in Pueblo pottery, where a new pot is always constructed out of shards of an old pot. So it occurred to me that if this practice is followed religiously, that what we would have is that the old is always wrapped up in the creation of the new. And so that's what I mean by original thinking. That's part of it anyway. I define it later on in other aspects, you know, that it's thankful, as we spoke about in the very beginning of this webinar. It's thankful. It comes from particular places or origins. It's thinking out of the box, yes, you know, which is the most common response when people say, what's original thinking? But it's also looks for the pattern that connects. What kinds of things want to happen together? It is radical thinking that goes to the roots. It is beautiful thinking, and it is wise thinking. Those are some of the aspects of original thinking. So I would say, yes, it is possible to at least move in the direction of becoming more of an original thinker. Not a good idea to claim that. You know, I don't claim that for myself either. I'm just saying that this is the wider and wiser and fuller continuum of consciousness that we can become aware of, the better, because that is increasingly inclusive, interconnected, and whole, and very healing. So I would leave that with you. And thank you. Blessings to everyone who came to join. Do we have any more linear time units, or are we?
I think we are out of time, and I think that was a perfect note to close on. Thank you all for joining us today, and thank you, Glenn, for facilitating this wonderful dialogue. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you very much. Blessings.